This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The YWCA is cutting another program because of the state fiscal mess. Home care, this time. Operations Vice President Liz German says not only are a couple hundred people losing service, some YWCA employees are losing jobs.
You know, in some cases we were able to retain people for other programs, but between the two of probably about 50 staff members.
Hear more about how the Y is trying to stabilize. Plus, District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley says not everything is great after the passage of the state budget in his area either. And what's new on the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A couple weeks ago, the YWCA of McLean County cut its Medivan program. Now it's lopping off its home care services effort in an effort to stabilize operations. Liz German is the vice president of operations for the Y.
With home care services, it's kind of a complicated program, but essentially what the budget impasse did was it caused two of the five providers to drop out of providing the service. And so for the last couple of years, it has been us and two other companies. And when that happened, our clientele tripled, and so our staff also tripled. And the way that the program is set up, there's a reimbursement rate for the hours where you serve the actual clients, but there is no reimbursement for any of the administrative fees, mileage to staff, administrative costs to supervise the program, software costs, training fees for the staff, all of those things. And so when all of those expenses tripled and the reimbursement coming in was not tripling as well, it put us in a very bad position financially. And then you add that on top of the fact that the state hasn't been paying for the service, basically that emphasized all of our financial issues. So in part it is the budget and the state not paying the bills, but the other part of it is just the structure of the program, how it's set up, what's reimbursed and what's not reimbursed.
First,
and the fact that we're doing serving so many clients.
How much does the state owe you for this particular program?
A little bit less than $300,000. We're at that $275,000 to $300,000 range.
Second, what is the annual unreimbursed expense to the Y that the state says we're not going to pay for that?
Last year it was $223,000. This year we're looking at probably a number around the same. We haven't, you know, closed the books. Our fiscal year ended June 30th. Last year, at the end of the fiscal year, that was our deficit. And that was assuming that the state paid all their bills, which did not happen.
First, there was Medivan, now home care services. What's left?
Well, the silver lining, I guess, is that those two programs were mostly state-funded and were very much driven by the state and how the state was doing. All of our other programs have more of a mixture of state funding, federal funding, local funding, donations, program fees. So this last move with home care services actually stabilizes us going forward to a position where we're pretty confident we won't have to make any more cuts as long as, you know, this budget that they've put in place stays in place and payments do come. So all the other programs are a better mixture of funding than Medivan and home care services.
Medivan was running a deficit of $140,000 a year, I think, and now $300,000 from the state on home care. How many people are leaving the Y as a result of this?
Between the two, you know, in some cases we were able to retain people for other programs, but between the two of probably about 50 staff members. We have worked with the two other companies that provide home care services that have a state contract, and we have interviews set up for our staff. The goal is to make sure that nobody misses a paycheck, and we're pretty confident we can make sure that happens so that the individual staff don't feel the burden of this.
We should clarify for listeners exactly what home care services entails, I think.
Sure. Yeah, home care services basically covers anything that is non-medical that helps keep people independent in their homes. So that's anything from cooking meals, doing laundry, reminding them to take their medicine, taking them to grocery shop, to a doctor's appointment, things that are not medically by nature, or medically related by nature, but they make sure somebody's healthy enough and can stay in their home. So without these kinds of services, even if somebody didn't have some sort of illness, you know, if they can't get their food or their medicine or cook meals, they might end up in a nursing home. So these services, even though they're not medical, are really important to make sure people stay in their homes and don't go to nursing homes, which inevitably costs the community and the state more money.
How many people were being helped by the Y in this program?
When we asked for the cap and ended up having to terminate the contract, we were at about 185 clients. Last year, we got up to 220, which was that big number really quickly. Right now, 185.
What happens to them?
So those clients will all shift to one of the two other companies that are that have a contract with the state of Illinois for this service. Those two companies serve multiple states, and they're not necessarily local companies. One of them has an office here. One of them, as of right now, they don't have an office. They might be getting one. So they're able to kind of take this on, hopefully, for a long time, but at least right now, because they have other states that are paying their bills and many more clientele to kind of balance out what Illinois is going through right now.
And they are for-profit companies.
They are for-profit, and they are not local. So that is the downside, but we do know that they will take the clients because the state contract is set up in a way that they have to take the clients. If they're given to them, you have to take the clients. You cannot say no.
What is the average difference in cost to deliver services between for-profit and non-profit operations in this field?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if we have that information. We do know the two other companies, like we said, they're for-profit. They are unionized. I don't know if they have any sort of, lobbying power where they can go to the state and say we need more money to provide this service or not. Theoretically, they would be getting the same reimbursement rate that we get, whether or not they're able to, you know, run the programs more efficiently or cheaper somehow because they do have such a bigger area that they serve. Theoretically, the reimbursement rate should be the same. My concern would be long-term that if, you know, this was such a burden on us financially, I don't know how it would not be on them eventually because now they're going to be in the position that we've been in for the last couple years. We tended to get all the increase in the clients because we were local. So now they're going to get this huge increase, and they're going to see it financially. And my hope is that they don't pull out at some point. But who knows? I mean, I don't know specifically what their financial setup is. So,
how much lower cost is something like home care services than something like nursing homes, the next logical step for these people if they can't be maintained in their home?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, when you look at our average client at YWCA gets about 5 hours of care a week, and so that costs the state about $17 an hour, so 17 times 5 a week to make sure they're independent in their homes. And I would assume that a nursing home is probably 10 times that cost for a week of care. I don't know the rates, but I have to imagine it's a huge increase if you take somebody who literally all they need is, you know, a meal, take their medicine, make sure they have groceries, and you're paying 5 hours of care versus, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's going to be a big jump.
You asked for a cap on the number of clients that the state denied. What would have been a workable cap for you?
we would have loved to continue the service at about 100 clients because we could have done that feasibly without putting the whole YWCA at risk. And the state said that that was not an option, and so this was our only other option with the contract the way it's set up. And so while we are sad that we can no longer offer the service, it was a necessary step for us. I just would want to kind of reiterate that we would have loved to be able to serve the seniors that we could have served if we had that flexibility with the state contract.
Liz German is the Vice President for Operation for the YWCA of McLean County, which has cut home care services.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, data privacy versus business uses of that data. Yes, there is a budget in the state of Illinois, but District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley says that's not the end of the story. There's a clause in that document about an evidence-based school funding formula that must be in place before any school district gets money from the state. There is no bill in place. One has passed the Senate. The governor has vowed to veto it because of the way it treats Chicago schools. Before the end of June, the GOP and Democratic versions of the measure weren't that far apart, except for Chicago and a couple other Republican asks, such as money for school vouchers. The challenge, Riley says, is getting it from the 95-yard line to the goal line.
I sure hope so. And yes, I think there is hope because I think the last thing that any, whether it's the governor or any legislature wants, is for some schools to not be able to start on time. And that's a very real possibility if they do not get this done. And eventually, of course, as time goes on, if a budget is not completed, that goes to pre-K-12 schools. That is just going to create more schools at different points in time that may have to close their doors. So given that disastrous of a potential result, I believe that they will. Now, my concern is that there's probably discussion going on right now as we speak over since this special session has ended. And those discussions, negotiations, whatever you want to call them, probably center around what you just raised about this issue with Chicago in particular. And whether or not they can resolve that, I don't know. But you've heard Madigan state that he had several demands after the governor had his own demands. And one of those was that the governor signed Senate Bill 1. And that has yet to reach his desk, as far as I understand. And it could be the political tactic is to give that to him at the last hour in the month of July to leave him very little time to make that decision in terms of when schools should get their start receiving their funding, which begins in August.
That can't feel very good for you.
No, and we're a district that's in a much better financial position than most. So there are school districts out there that are very concerned about what this means for the immediacy in their world. For me, in District 87, life will go on. We will start the year and nothing changes, except that, of course, we're drawing fund reserves when we could be utilizing these funds. So it's a very big issue and a big problem for many school districts.
Any talk of a special session to avoid this brinksmanship that you approach that you just mentioned, having the bill released to the governor in late July?
I have not heard of any. However, that doesn't mean that couldn't be in the works. I do believe that there are folks having those discussions, even though, of course, I'm not privy to that. I doubt that there's just this simple end of the special session with this looming out there. Whether or not those are productive, only time will tell. But at some point, there has to be a decision that's reached on this. And it could be that this Senate Bill 1 is sent to the governor as is, and then he has to make a decision. If that occurs, my hope is that he signs it and life goes on. If it doesn't occur, or if he vetoes that bill, or if he receives it and sits on it for a period of time, because he has up to 60 days, I believe, that presents challenges, as we know. And after, if that were to occur, there's a lot of questions up in the air for many of us that I don't have the answers to.
Like what?
Well, right now it's very difficult to plan a budget with that big of an unknown. We have yet to really get substantial numbers based on anything, because there's really nothing to base it on. We can go with some hypotheticals. If they pass Senate Bill 1 as is, for example, we can begin to try to plan that out. But the budget begins to be presented in August and gets finalized in September. And yeah, we can do budget amendments as time goes on, but it makes it very difficult to plan and to do things in an appropriate way when you have that big of a piece of your budget that's unknown. And again, we're a district that doesn't rely as much on the state finances as others do. However, I don't mean to diminish the importance of it. It's just we rely more on our local revenues than we do the state. But those state revenues are very important to us. Also buried within this bill, you have what appears to me to be a shift of the what I believe is the state's portion of the pension cost for new employees coming into the system. And that hasn't been talked about much at all. If you recall, there was a lot of discussion about shifting the cost of the pension onto the local districts within the budget that has been passed. I shouldn't say the bill, because it's not tied to Senate Bill 1. The budget that's been passed, it shifts the cost of that state pension to the local districts, I believe, simply for new employees. And that's not part of our budget planning right now. So that's an additional cost we may have to take on.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're speaking with Barry Riley, the superintendent of District 87 schools. Well, how many new employees do you have in any given year? How long does it take for your workforce to turn over? What's the percentage of turnover in a year? And can you use those kinds of benchmarks to get a handle on the obligation?
Absolutely. That we have a sense of, you know, on average how many new TRS, Teacher Retirement System employees, we get in a given year. And I'll say it's 13 to 15 new ones of a staff of about 400, let's say. So, you know, obviously that would take time for those new employees to have an impact, a significant impact on the budget. Each year it would just grow. And if you think back to when the state was having discussions about shifting this to the local districts, they were talking about doing it over some period of time, whether it was 7 years, 12 years, 19 years, whatever the number that was used. So if you think about it in those terms, it's probably what they were thinking is, okay, if we start with new employees, there's this gradual shift of the cost. But again, it's not as if we're getting a bunch of new money to take that additional cost on. It does make things much more difficult for us. But given that we at least have the knowledge of how many we can expect, that helps us to plan for that better than if we didn't know that.
And it would give districts an incentive to end what had been a fairly common practice of pension sweeteners for some workers in the final year or 2 years of their contracts.
Well, I think those days have been dramatically reduced, in some cases gone. There are still a number of districts that provide retirement incentives over the course of several years. We're one of those. In our case, it's a employees have the potential for a 6% increase in each of 3 years, as long as they retire at the end of those 3 years. And they have to. There's other qualifiers, but that's the basic deal that they would receive.
And the reason for that is succession planning.
Succession planning, and those, of course, are your higher salaried employees, and the savings that you potentially get from their retirement, hiring in somebody new at a much lower level, there's benefit there. And that is built on an assumption that those folks will indeed retire, because if you don't have that in place, there's no guarantee that they would retire at that same point in time. And it's really difficult to do a study to show, you know, whether or not they would.
The state, though, has griped for years, though, that externalizes the cost, because your pension is based on a certain percentage of your closing salary.
Right. And in the past, you had districts that used to do, and it's been years now, but 20% increases in a final year or even multiple final years. That's where things started to really impact the pension system, when you had these major ballooned pensions at the end of a career. One of the things I really felt that the state could have done or still could do at some point in time is just cap the earnings that they're going to count toward pensionable earnings, instead of allowing that number to be whatever it is and penalizing whether it's individuals or school districts. They could say that, look, in those final years, you can pay them anything you want. However, we're only going to count X percent more towards the pension, and that certainly provides them with, okay, now we know exactly where this threshold is going to be.
It becomes moot, though, if districts are slowly assuming the obligations.
Absolutely. Certainly, that if that shift comes to the districts, then the locals can make those decisions. And that is probably better, because then the local decisions know the impact on their budgets, and budgets will vary across the state. And so if they have control over that, then they ought to be able to budget in a way that they only spend what they can support.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Barry Riley is our guest today. He's the superintendent of District 87 Schools. It has been, 2008, 2009 since was the last time that schools in Illinois got everything that they were promised from the state. Is that going to change with the new budget, or will there still be proration? Will there still be reductions in categorical amounts? What will this budget bring you?
I suspect that we will see the state continue to lag behind, and hopefully there will be a day when they catch up. But I expect that I don't expect that we will get every payment that we're due, because they're still behind. If you think about the millions and millions of dollars that they're behind in payments today, there's no magical way to catch up immediately. And so I suspect that'll be a gradual catch up. In our case, we're about $2 million behind in our payments. So I don't see that we're going to get all of that money in this coming school year, assuming they're able to complete this budget for the pre-K-12 schools. And in addition, get our 2018 allocated money. I just don't see that's possible, given the numbers that they're talking about. However, over time, they ought to be able to chip away at that and eventually catch up. Hopefully sooner rather than later, but I'm just hopeful that we get a budget in place for pre-K-12 right now, And if they can give us, most of what they should, then we'll be progressing towards that finish of getting everything.
Is sooner rather than later really a Pollyanna, wild-eyed optimist kind of framework, though? The state is going to have to allocate about half of its revenue toward retiring old bills first. So it's not likely that it's going to be sooner.
Recent history certainly shows us that that is most likely true, so I don't disagree with you, Charlie. I think that it's probably more optimism than reality. But if they're making progress towards that, that's much better than where we have been. And so while I don't disagree, I think it's probably great optimism to think that that's going to come sooner rather than later. I'm hoping that we see progress chipping away at it.
The last time you were up, you were noting the row of flags and the construction along the BHS and BJHS campus corridor. What is the latest on the construction?
That construction is moving along very well. In fact, I would encourage folks to take a ride down Locust Street heading towards Bloomington High School and Bloomington Junior High. Those are really our marquee buildings because they're the highest concentration of our student population. Every kid that comes through the district eventually ends up in those two buildings. And the campus is a beautiful campus. We've done a lot of work to maintain and upgrade our facilities. It's a source of pride. And when you come down that row now, you'll see a very nice Bloomington Public Schools sign that sits on the corner of Colton and Locust, where our maintenance shed used to be. You'll see rows of pennants and flagpoles coming down Locust Street. And it really says to the community that we value these premises and we want our community to be proud. We also see how it plays a role in economic development, and that's important in this community. We think it increases the value of the properties around it. I think that's something that's important. So I'm real proud of it. We've had a lot of compliments on it, and it's one of those things that sends a message that Bloomington Public Schools cares about not only its students, its staff, but also what this portrays out in the community.
Barry Riley is the superintendent of District 87 Schools. He joins us periodically on Sound Ideas.
Next time on Ask Me Another, actor Chris Colfer joins us to talk about playing Kurt on the TV series Glee and about his YA book series, The Land of Stories. Plus, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Jonathan Colton leads a music parody game about cities nobody admits they're from. Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia. Ask Me Another, tomorrow morning at 10 on GLT, News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, photosynthesis in the age of global climate change. What information is tracked when you're online? Several lawmakers want more transparency on that. Business groups say consumer protections are already in place. Illinois Issues' Daisy Contreras explores the data privacy debate.
Thousands of phone applications and websites exist to help us track our health, fitness goals, and sleep cycles. When Carolyn Parrish was looking to download a woman's health and menstrual tracker on her phone, she noticed many of these apps required access to her location and access to her contacts. That made her uneasy.
There are a lot of apps out there that will take more information than they need to operate. And it's solely for data mining purposes, you know, to create this sort of marketing database.
Parrish is a privacy professional, and her business depends on knowing the ins and outs of privacy policy. The reality is, many companies will track our location and browsing habits for business and marketing purposes.
The most important thing is that people have protections online, and they should have the right to know if a website's collecting information and sharing it and selling it with third parties. And some of that information is extremely sensitive, and it needs to be protected.
That's State Senator Michael Hastings, a Democrat from Orland Hills. He sponsors one of the two privacy measures considered this year. His Right to Know proposal would allow consumers to request the data that companies tracked and who they sold it to. Another measure would require app developers and website owners to ask before tracking a user's geolocation. But several business groups say that Illinois already has enough laws protecting consumers and their online data.
These are not bills that would require companies to do anything different than they're doing today as far as protecting data. These are more bills about what the consumer should know and when the consumer should know it.
That was Tanya Trish Thewood, Vice President and General Counsel for the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, which represents retail businesses across the state. She says these measures add unnecessary burdens on the business community in a time when many are already struggling to make a profit. Other opponents say the added regulations would create loopholes for trial lawyers to pick on businesses. But advocates say they can make sure that both sides get what they need without compromising consumer protections. Still, the battle continues. This has gone as far as several business organizations publicly declaring these two measures, among others, as anti-business and anti-employer. Matthew Erickson, Industry Outreach Director for Digital Privacy Alliance, a Chicago privacy advocacy group, disagrees.
We see this as a pro-business sort of thing. We feel that this has a net bonus on business. We feel that these bills, by essentially establishing a level playing field of trust, will encourage consumers to reach out more and help small businesses get that leg up of immediate trust.
So why the ongoing debate? John Verdi has one explanation. He is the Vice President of Policy at the Future of Privacy Forum in Washington, D.C., and has previously worked on privacy matters for the Obama administration. He says the nature of the issue is a complicated one, especially when at the federal level, there are no laws to regulate online data collection.
So I think it's helpful to frame these conversations instead of talking about data and what companies do with data or what users do with data or who owns the data. I think it's more helpful to really focus on the sensitive data categories, because those are the things that matter most to consumers.
If this is the case, more dialogue might be needed in Illinois. The geolocation measure passed both houses and awaits the governor's signature. But the Right to Know Act has stalled in the House. While legislators try to hash out final details, Carolyn Parrish, the woman who wanted a simple health tracker for her phone, wants developers and businesses to consider this added transparency with consumers.
Giving people greater visibility into what's happening behind the scenes, it's useful. It's knowledge is helpful to consumers to make educated choices.
For Illinois Issues, I'm Daisy Contreras.
NPR's Here and Now comes your way weekdays at 1 on GLT. A lot happens during the day. That's why NPR's Jeremy Hobson and Robin Young anchor a team of reporters and give you interviews to keep you updated between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Tune in for the news at 1 weekdays during Here and Now on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a grim musical, as in Brothers Grimm. Researchers with the University of Illinois' Crop Research Project, realizing increased photosynthetic efficiency, or RIPE for short, invited the media and public to a field day. They showed off some of their research on increasing photosynthesis in plants, which they believe will turn increased plant biomass and crop yields. Don Ort is the associate director of the RIPE project and a crop science professor at the U of I. He gave IPR's Brian Moline an overview of the project, starting with the challenges that climate change, or as he calls it, global change, presents to agriculture.
And so one aspect of global change is the increasing CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, as we're all aware. That in and of itself could actually be a benefit to agriculture because CO2 is the substrate for photosynthesis. Unfortunately, as we all know, as CO2 increases in the atmosphere, so does temperature. And so does the evaporative demand of the atmosphere for water that exists, you know, not only in the soil but in crop plants. And so temperature in particular, based on experiments that we've done here in our global change research facility at Soyface, when we increase the temperature of soybean canopies by 3 degrees through the entire growing season, we see a decrease in yield. This is the opposite of increasing the yield 70%. We're going to have to figure out how to make plants more resilient to these higher temperatures just to sustain yield, much less to increase it by 70%.
Now let's talk about some of the research you're doing here to try and increase photosynthesis in plants. If you could just give us an overview of the process you're using to try and do that, to increase the photosynthesis in plants here.
And so there's very good evidence that if we can increase the photosynthetic performance of plants, there'll be a proportional increase in yield. Plants evolved and photosynthesis evolved in a very different situation than what we have in modern agriculture. And so they evolved as a situation of solitary plants. And the traits of solitary plants to be competitive is very different than what we want in an agricultural field. The other thing that's happened is plants evolved, the ancestors of plants evolved in an atmosphere that was 220 parts per million and we're already in 400 parts per million CO2. And so we need to rebalance photosynthesis in terms of the different processes of photosynthesis that have been put out of balance by this increase in CO2 concentration. We know a lot about photosynthesis mechanistically. We're able to model it in silico, and those models suggest to us what we need to tweak to be able to increase performance. The way that we've chosen to do this is to use transgenics to overexpress enzymes that we think are limiting, replace enzymes that are temperature labile with ones that aren't from different organisms, and in this way, in a very organized and structured way to try to improve performance to these different challenges that are coming up. In doing this, we have used model species in order to do proof of concept. As we get proof of concept in model species and that it performs in the field, then we start moving them into crop plants of, you know, that we know about in the Midwest, of corn and soybean and so on. But also plants that are food security plants in other parts of the world, like cassava and cowpea and so on.
Yeah, and if you could expand on that a little bit, especially cassava, cowpea, and their importance, particularly in Africa.
A good portion of our research here is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and they're interested in getting improved productivity to the subsistence farmer in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. And so the crops that are important there are cowpea, cassava. Many people aren't even familiar with cassava, but from the standpoint of production, it's the eighth most important crop in the world. It produces more than 50% of the calories that keep people alive in sub-Saharan Africa. But it's virtually an unimproved crop. And so we want to help increase the yield of cassava, which hasn't changed in the last 3 decades, by increasing the photosynthetic performance. Again, transferring the things that we have validated in model crops, validated in the field here, and then move them into cassava and anticipate the same kind of benefits that we've seen in model crops here.
How is the U of I able to become involved with the Gates Foundation to bring this research here to Urbana?
University of Illinois has a very long history in the excellence of photosynthesis. It goes back probably six decades. And so we were actually contacted by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for a convening. And so they were interested in an article that Steve Long and I wrote about manipulating photosynthesis as a strategy to increase yield. And they asked us to gather a dozen experts around the world, come to Seattle and talk to them about it. And so that's what we did. A few months later, they contacted us and they said that they would like a proposal. They'd like one proposal. They want it from the University of Illinois, and that we should identify our international collaborators that we would like to work with us, and then come to Seattle and write the proposal. And that's what we did. And so within a period of 6 months from when we were first contacted, we were funded.
And is there a particular timeline on the funding from the Gates Foundation? You know, how do you see this progressing here?
The first award was for 5 years, and so we're a bit over 4 years into that now. Over the past few months, we have been interacting with the Gates Foundation for reinvestment, and it's virtually certain at this point that that there will be a reinvestment for another 5 years. And there's certainly the provision and the current, I think, intention of the Gates Foundation to make this even a longer-term project than just another 5 years.
If this is a successful project, if you achieve what you want to achieve, what will the results be, and when will we start to see those results in fields, whether it be in Africa, whether it be here with crops? When will we start to see those results?
Yeah, really good question. And so I think that we've already been successful, and so some of the traits that our modeling suggested would improve photosynthetic efficiency that would translate into increased biomass yield, we've demonstrated actually does do that. And so now we have those traits, we know how to control them, and we're starting to move them from our model plant into some of these crop plants. And so part of in the reinvestment period, we'll be moving these into cowpea as well as the soybean and into rice. And so I would say that we will probably be field testing some of these things in cowpea and soybean within 2 years. But going from that point to getting into the farmer's field is conservatively another 10 years. And so that's why, you know, when the UNFAO says we need to increase food production 70% in the next three decades, it's really urgent because, you know, a breeding cycle conservatively is 12 years. And so we're just a couple of breeding cycles away from, you know, when yields have to be that much higher. And as you pointed out earlier, it needs to be done in the face of global change.
That's U of I Crop Sciences Professor Don Ort. He's with the RIPE project, which seeks to increase crop yields by increasing photosynthesis in plants. The University Galleries in Uptown Normal presents Illuminance, a collection of work that combines sculpture and light created by Dennis French. The show continues through August 9th. Discover more arts events listed at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Just how much would you give up for love? That's one of the questions that faces Ariel, the little mermaid with a beautiful singing voice in the classic Hans Christian Andersen tale that becomes one of the most successful animated films of all time. The Disney movie was adopted into a Broadway musical that is now on stage at Bloomington's Community Players. GLT's Judy Valente has more about the show with director Chris Turvin.
Seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. The Little Mermaid, with its singing sea creatures, ushered in a new era in Disney animation. It was the precursor of all those blockbuster film and stage musicals that followed, including Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King. The Little Mermaid stage production was not a hit with some Broadway theater critics, but audiences loved it. A six-week run in Denver sold out every night, 95,000 seats. Now, Bloomington Normal audiences will have a chance to see if the stage version contains everything they loved about the original animated film. Director Chris Turvin of Community Players says the charm of the play lies in its story of what happens when two outsiders from different worlds come together in love.
With Disney, everything seems to have a moral, and there's always a villain. So you have both of those options to play with. Ariel basically wanting to escape what she doesn't feel is right for her and finding, true love, a place where she feels she belongs, even despite the fact that she would have to leave her family to do so.
Ariel, will explain for anybody who possibly doesn't know, is the Little Mermaid who longs to be part of the larger culture.
Absolutely.
It's kind of a universal story in that you have the outsider wanting to be in, but you also have the person saying, I'm different and that's okay.
Exactly. And she feels different. I mean, she feels like a fish out of water.
I've got who's its and what's its galore. You want thingamabobs? I've got 20. But who cares? No big deal. I want more. I want to be where the people are.
But she's in a torn situation because she doesn't want to leave her family, and she does love her father, and she just lost her mother. So those are all things that, you know, want her to look back towards her family. But at the same time, she knows that's not where she belongs. That's what she feels in her heart, and she has to pursue that.
Why did Community Players decide to put on Little Mermaid? There's so many choices for musicals. I'm always curious as to how you choose the ones that you do.
Well, we've really been trying to do a balanced offer lately with classics like The Little Mermaid, based on Hans Christian Andersen, and newer items. We have Sister Act coming up next season. That, of course, is then balanced with Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and our other musical, which is Into the Woods by Stephen Sondheim.
Another fairy tale type musical.
Absolutely.
But a much darker treatment of fairy tales.
And a lot more fun.
One thing I wondered about were the costumes in Little Mermaid. You can understand how they could do this in an animated Disney film, make Ariel look like a mermaid, but that's different on stage. What are you doing with the costuming?
Well, our costumer, Amy Kerber, has put together a team, because it takes a village for this one, of about 12 different people that have modified, sewn from scratch, to basically make as much fantasy appear on stage as possible. I mean, we had to give the incredible Jennifer Rusk 8 arms. And
the octopus.
The mermaid's tails were hand-sewn, each one for all of the Mer sisters. Just a huge endeavor from a costuming perspective, but they have turned out just spectacular. There's so much color and light and fantasy on that stage, just in the costumes alone.
How difficult is it to find the talent to do these roles? Because it's a rather strenuous singing role for the major players.
Absolutely. The one thing that we are blessed with in Bloomington Normal is an abundance of talent. We have both the colleges to draw from. We have amazing high school theater and opportunities for students in the area to start out at a young age and get infected with that theater bug. And that just keeps the talent coming forward.
Sitting there across the way, she don't got a lot to say, but there's something about her. And you don't know why, but you're dying to try. You wanna kiss the girl.
Is there any difference between the film version, the famous Disney animated film, and the musical on stage?
Oh, absolutely. The music was written by Alan Menken and Howard Ashman with additional lyrics by Glenn Slater for the Broadway production. Menken and Ashman wrote the original score for the movie, but they added several more songs for the Broadway production and actually added some new lyrics for existing songs. And I mean, some of the music is just incredible, and some of the talent we have delivering it is doing it justice all over the place.
What are some of the new songs?
I believe Positivity is one of the newer songs sung by the Seagull Scuttle. Ursula's henchmen have a number called Sweet Child, and that's also a new one.
Chris Turvin is the producer of the ongoing production of The Little Mermaid at Community Players. You can see it this weekend. Thanks so much, Chris.
My pleasure, Judy.
I'm Judy Valente.
Oh, is that tuberty? Why, there's no such word.
Of course there is, in the dictionary, right between popsicle and pre-hysterical. Believe you me, I seen it work miracles. Now he's a schmo,
yo,
and he's a schlep,
yeah,
and this one doesn't got the sharpest rep.
The Little Mermaid is on stage at Community Players this evening through Sunday and next Thursday through Sunday. There is Positivity. It's one of the songs that was added to the New York stage production, sung by the original Broadway cast. You can hear more music from The Little Mermaid and other Broadway shows every Wednesday at 7 on GLT's Center Stage. You'll hear sound ideas each weekday on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast or individual interviews. WGLT.org is also where you can find contact information to let us know what you think of this show or share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
We got natural talent, what I like to call go ability.
See Mr. Bip and the Bop and the Bop Bop Boo. You can flip and clap till your wish comes true.
This is GLT 89.1 FM, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.